As we start our study session of Thursday, November 19th, first I'd like to excuse the mayor who is doing city business on the other side of the country. And we also excuse Councilmember Higgins who won't be able to join us today. And Dave, it's so good that you could make it here with us this morning. We delayed and tried to wait for you, but we're started.
It's fun having kids that hide your badge.
All right. With that, we will start by hearing a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on zoning ordinance update. Let's see what we have.
Vice Mayor Jones, members of the council, last night when we made a similar presentation to the Planning and Zoning Board, I described it as a momentous occasion, but I'm not sure everybody else has necessarily that same view. I have that particular view because we've been working on this for a long time. We started this project in September of 2006, and we started it, one, by hiring a consultant, Michael Diet, who's flown here from San Francisco and with us today, and to describe some of the work that we've done. But we also started by going out and talking to folks who use the zoning ordinance. We started with a process called stakeholder interviews, and we had, if I remember correctly, somewhere between 12 and 20 sets of interviews where we actually talked to different focus groups about how they use the code, what they thought of the code, what they thought could be changed, what they thought was right about it. We used that as kind of as a foundation point, as well as doing an analysis of the entire general plan of the existing zoning code to find out what was wrong and what needed to be changed, the things that we could do to make this zoning code better and make it work and function more easily for the general public. It's taken a while for us to figure out how to do this. This has kind of been a process. We've had lots of meetings. I've been working with six or seven, depending upon if that board's functioning that month or not, advisory boards, and talking to these folks as we've gone. We've presented them with different parts of the code, asked for their comments. We've incorporated their comments into the document. Michael has been very flexible in listening to our needs and what he, and then providing us with advice as to how we can address some of these issues. And I think we have a document that does quite a bit to address some of the issues that we've had, at least on the zoning standpoint of several issues. What we like to do today is present to you what we call our council review draft. This is a consolidation of all of the different modules that we've had over the last 3 years. We've kind of broken the code into four parts. We've analyzed those four parts probably to death, ad nauseum more likely, and then reassembled the code back into a document so that it works and functions as a whole. From this point, what we're asking for is if you see things that you feel we need to tweak or there needs to be additional direction made, we'll take those, we'll make those modifications, and we're going to do what we refer to as one final public review draft. This is the document that we're going to then start vetting through the public process, where we'll go through and we'll talk to individual groups that have an interest in the code, the different special interest group, the different lobbying groups, homeowners associations, if the Toastmasters or the Lions or the Rotary Clubs want to listen to it, we'll make presentations to those folks. But we want to go through a very extensive public process once we get past this point to say, here's what we're proposing to do, here's the changes we'd like to make, what do you think, and get their feedback. Incorporate that feedback into it, and then start the public hearing process probably after a period of about 4 months or so. So we're looking at once we make this, we'll make the changes at the start of the year because we're getting into the holiday season. We'll start a public review process, and then we'll start public hearings probably sometime around March or April with probably two hearings through the Planning and Zoning Board, and then coming back to you folks probably sometime in May or June. So that's kind of our address. With that, again, we've got Mr. Diet here, and he's going to go through and take you kind of step by step through the document itself.
Thank you, Gordon, Vice Mayor, members of the council, and staff. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to first thank Gordon and all the staff and the P&Z board and DRB and the others who really have helped make our life much easier in putting together a document that we hope meets Mesa's needs. What I'd like to do is expand on some of the detail that Gordon talked about in terms of setting out the overall context, what were our goals, and talk about some of the general changes we made throughout the ordinance, and then walk you through each of the main six parts. I'd like this to be informal. We certainly will have plenty of time for questions, but if at any point I'm saying something that is obscure, you'd like to ask me a question, please feel free. And I'm a zoner. I really love to write zoning. Our office just does general plans and zoning. We are always looking at ways to make it easier. So we embraced a lot of the goals that have been set out in the beginnings. It's all about saying what a city's expectations are, being clear. You have standards, they're what you can map or measure, so everyone knows and you'd have a predictable outcome. And they know what the process is, they know there's going to be certainty and finality at the end, and how the ordinance can provide relief. And if we do that well, then we will streamline the approval process. It's very, what we call findings driven. I'll come back to that. But that's writing down what the criteria are for approval. And if a project meets the criteria, great. They have an expectation of pulling their permit. As Mesa has matured, the edges of growth are now pretty set. And you're looking in at some of the bypassed, skipped over land. And you're no longer going to be a suburban community in all of the areas. In fact, with the new rail coming in the town center, there's interest in portions of the city in becoming more urban. So infill development was another important idea, becoming urban and looking at infill, facilitating that, getting investment. We wanted to have a high level of urban design for everyone, not just those who might do the planned area development or a project down on the proving ground. Every development should be expected to produce high quality design. At the same time, we want to promote housing variety and choice and make sure that we're not standing in the way of new jobs, that this new ordinance can contribute to economic development and vitality. And at the same time, enhance environmental quality. You can continue to be a good steward in the valley of what you have. So overall, one of the first things we did, as you do with many old ordinances, is try to create an order. So it's not just a series of amendments over time that got fit in, and it's very hard to navigate your current ordinance was. So we like a hierarchy. How should it be arranged? Typically, you put the frequently consulted provisions up front, less frequently consulted provisions and administrative matters in the back, and definitions are last. They're just for reference. They don't make policy. When you have lists of things, it's always better to just alphabetize them. Then everyone knows that there's no implied priority, but there's an order. And with lots of tables and charts and cross-references, it's going to be easier to find your way around the ordinance. You don't duplicate provisions, say it once, because that way when you do amendments, you don't have the risk of having one section say one thing and another conflict with it, because you may not have amended all the right sections. I know the city attorney would not let that happen, but that is a good reason for not duplicating provisions. Keep it clear, keep it tight. So these are the kinds of tables that we would be using for people to look up a permitted use, see what district it might be allowed in, and what the additional regulations are that apply. This table and a related one on standards are really what we call the heart of the zoning ordinance. And they're very useful at the counter, because when someone comes in who may not be familiar with Mesa zoning, the staff member can open the zoning or it can be online, and they see with hyperlinks or turning the pages exactly how to navigate to find their way around the code. We've consolidated all the design and development standards, putting them either in the specific zones where they apply or in an article where they would apply citywide. And by doing that, we eliminated that those two separate chapters on design guidelines you now have. The mandatory elements in the design guidelines are integrated in the zones or citywide and carried forward. The more generic, this is good design 101, is not part of the code. That can certainly be part of city council, city planning division handouts, but we want this code to clearly incorporate the standards and the rules and regulations and not just be a design wish list. It's got a lot of new graphics. Pictures do convey ideas more strongly than tables. And it's much easier to explain at the counter how a drawing relates to an applicant's site plan if you have that drawing right there in front of you. I'd now like to take a few minutes to go through the various articles. We start with the introductory provisions. This sets the stage. It tells people how the yes, please.
You wanted it to be interactive right throughout?
Sure.
Okay, good. Because you were talking about one of the general changes in the charts. I was wondering if it might behoove us to have, I think it's in the back where it defines each abbreviation.
Yes.
But it always drives me crazy when you're reading through something and there's acronyms. There's two letter things like, oh, shoot, what did that stand for again? And you have to flip somewhere. If there's like on the front cover inside all the abbreviations spelled out, this is what these mean. So you know exactly where to go for it very simply. So when I'm reading through and I'm reading DRDB-2 district, I'm like, oh, what did that stand for again? It's just right there. Either that or you put it with every chart. But I would think inside front cover would be the easiest thing. So if it has a two-letter or capitalized abbreviation, it has a ready access definition to it.
Excellent idea. Thank you.
What
we're doing in introductory provisions is explaining the overall structure of the code and how language is used. Shells and mays, whether a series of things are all required, or it's A, B, C, or D, or the and/or, meaning you could have a choice. A new idea is to put rules of measurement up front. The Planning and Zoning Board often wrestled with how height is measured. You know, is it to the gutter? Is it halfway up the roof? Is it to the roof line? Do you go to the sidewalk? Do you go to the finish grade? Do you go to the average grade? By putting all of those things down, have one rule of height measurement, everyone's life is easier. And it's integrated with the rules and ideas in the building code. We also established the basic authority for preparing a zoning map and say what the districts are. There are most of the zones that you have in this code are the same zones you've had before. But we've renamed some of them, not rezoned, but renamed. So R1 and R2 and R3 have become this RS, residential single family, residential small lot, which is new, and the RM, the multifamily. Because those letter designations then mean something more than the old numbers. So light industrial, general industrial, heavy industrial, and the planned employment are names we're trying to use to make sense. So we'll have downtown. And with downtown, you have residences, businesses, and commercial areas. You have transit-oriented mixed use, which would be another district, TMX. Public and semi-public, it makes sense to call it PS. Planned community, which you'd adopted a couple of years ago, is the PC. We're offering a greater opportunity for mixing uses within a set urban form. So it's a ordinance that allows for more activity on the lot and in the vertically in the stores. We also want to make sure we can say yes to the small restaurants and cafes, say in the office district. So we're making a more walkable city. Someone then doesn't have to jump in their car in the middle of the day. They can walk to a corner store or a corner restaurant. And similarly, in the residential districts, why not let some of the land on the arterials and the collectors be used for small-scale office or retail uses. It just helps revitalize, get potential sales tax dollars in the community, and create walkability. Another change we've implemented is to increase slightly the densities in the residential zones. Not significant changes, but I think changes that will make a difference, will make you competitive in the valley. And it just will provide for a little bit more sensible land use. It's not going to result in rows of buildings with no side yards, but small increases in density that Gordon and others thought made sense. In the same way, there's an allowance for some adjustments. As you grow up in your buildings, you often say, gee, I really do want to extend that patio, or I need a front stoop to a bigger porch. Well, let's say yes to those kinds of things. Let's, though, make zoning be good neighbors. It's all about being a good neighbor. So if you have a multifamily project next to a single family project, the upper story should step back more, 35 feet, 45 feet if you have three stories. That keeps light and air in the neighborhoods, and it provides, again, that sense of land use compatibility. We've added some ideas that come back to that urban form concept. You're not just a suburban community today with everyone using their car. You have some pedestrian-oriented areas. Well, let's call those what they are, what we'd like them to be, with a P designation, so that's pedestrian. Similarly, the shopping centers are going to remain auto-oriented in the auto rows, so give them an A designation, where deeper setbacks, driveways, auto activity is fine. And in the areas that might be in transition, where you'd like it to become more pedestrian-oriented, but it is a transition or a mixed area, we'd use the M designation. These kinds of approaches to introduce urban form into the base districts have really been successful around the country, and I think it's a good addition for Mesa. I mentioned the urban feel. This also means allowing for a little more height and density in certain zones. We've also wanted to be very clear on what the purposes of zoning is. I like to say that if you can get the purposes right in each zone, it's very easy to write the use regulations and standards that follow. They're expressions of your council's legislative intent. And they also really help then at the counter, because the staff can go back and say, the intent of this district is, and this project clearly doesn't meet the intent. Or if you're getting an appeal or a project's going to the Board of Adjustment, you look to purpose statements to see whether you're true to the ideas for that district. We have this new small lot district I'd mentioned, where we want to be providing for those who need smaller lots. Interestingly, at the ULI convention last week, one of the analysts of long-term demand was saying we probably have enough large lots in this country, but as we look at the baby boomers aging, and I feel one of those, it's the smaller lot projects and maybe the townhouses that might be needed. So the lot area would be in the 25 to 4,500 foot range zero lot line development. These would still be ownership fee title lots, but slightly smaller in size. Many cities, as large as Los Angeles even, are embracing this option. As of right, it makes sense. It works well in the neighborhoods. There would be required streetscape and site design elements, so you're not having snout garages at these small lots. And you would have outdoor living area, 400 square feet, so that it's not just a paved over garage with tiny little edges. It's really have some, because your climate is such, you need to design and make sure the new development provides that. Similarly, we have this new mixed-use district, the MX district, to allow a mix of uses and residential densities in the 15 to 25 range, with more detail on pedestrian-oriented elements, engaging the street with the entries, having views into buildings to window displays, glass doors. So there's just a sense of pedestrian interest as they walk down it. No blank walls, restrictions on the parking lot location, so you get the parking on the side and the rear. And maximum setbacks are a way of keeping the buildings closer to the street. Again, we'd like to have outdoor eating areas, as we were talking about, outdoor living areas and design standards for garages. We've drawn these up so people see the expectations of what the storefronts are, very much the Main Street look, and how shade can be provided. Being able to have shade in these pedestrian-oriented areas is very important. And this could be done through arcades, overhangs, landscaping, or freestanding shade structures. We've drafted up a transit-oriented mixed-use district to work along the Main Street corridor as you plan for the extension of the light rail from Dobson to promote dense activity and have those same pedestrian-oriented design elements, but really require what we call active frontages, at least 50% of the ground floor. So it's relating to the transit areas, and it becomes attractive as the train rolls into town. There are two densities, sub-areas, if you will, one within about an eighth of a mile of the transit stop, we call it the TMX, and the other going out to the quarter mile, we call the TMX2, where the density would be moderate, more right around the station, stepping down as you go out. And in all cases, we'd have bicycle requirements, really make it easy to get to these stations. The PC district you've all seen came to you 2 years ago as an ordinance, and I think it's now been used in at least one project that you have in the community. All we've done here is brought it in to the code, fixed it, fixed the style and format so it is integrated. There are seven overlay districts that we have. Most of these, all of these in, except one, are districts you now have. We just organized them in a new way. I want to just touch on the infill zone district because an idea that emerged in the early discussions was to promote infill. And you have the skips and the dips, the development incentive and the substantial conformance improvement permits that Gordon can do, but they're limited in area and they don't offer as of right infill incentives. And that's one thing this new infill zone can do. It can take a larger area and can clearly say if the area is set up by the council, mapped, then the owners know what the rules are going in. They're not going to have to negotiate them at a public hearing. So this, I thought, is a way to get some job development in areas. Now, there are some criteria relating to where you'd map it. We've had some comments on those from the Planning and Zoning Commission. We don't have to keep the economic criteria in. We can just go with the idea that these are bypassed sites and that they be identified through a planning process, be identified by the council or the PAZ. The criteria were intended to say that we wanted to use this for the areas where there's some distress, but it became apparent that a community that's in an older area might have a neighborhood watch program, so they may not have the gang-related activities. Well, let's still make them potential candidates for this infill zone.
All right, we have another question for you.
This is the one that I read with interest, being in West Mesa. This is a great read, by the way. You guys done a great job. I noticed there's no provision for single-family residential in the infill district. Now, it's just in some infill parcels, it was appropriate. I kind of looked around. I might have just missed it. But as I read, there's some parcels that may be appropriately suited to have single-family residential on a bypass parcel. I can think of several in West Mesa that are in the middle of single-family resident neighborhoods. And I know there is some development interest in doing those as single-family residential, and it's difficult to do. Why was that?
One of the things that we did do with the infill overlay district is that if you map an area with a single residence district, the R16, what we currently call the R16 district, with the infill overlay, it kicks in a graduated density schedule. So rather than being a linear type of approach where you would have, say, the typical 3 to 4 units an acre that you might normally get in an R16, it would allow the densities to double by doing land assembly. And so we provide an economic assembly that, or an economic incentive that way. I think you're correct. We probably don't have specific language about infill enabling single family from the standpoint of attached single family or detached single family, but those are fairly easy fixes.
Okay, thank you.
I will say it.
Over here. On the overlay zones, how would we address, as I look at these, I don't see anything in here that addresses the rural lifestyle, which I think Lehigh would be an example of, or the desert uplands. Where would that fit in for overlays?
The Lehigh district we're doing, it's an equestrian district we're doing through the nuisance laws. It's not part of the zoning code. We're basically just enabling additional livestock provisions. Basically, they can keep more livestock on their property, and we're defining that separately. That's in a different title than the zoning code. As far as the desert uplands goes, that's defined through the subdivision regulations. That's in Title 9 of the city code. So that's also outside of the zoning district.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. Just piggybacking on Councilman Richens, to me, that probably is one of the most dynamic issues that I'm hoping we address and aggressively address is infill, the residential component. If there was, I'm hoping to get that feedback as you take this around that people understand. Having looked throughout District 2, there's a lot of opportunities for infill, but they don't exactly fit. And I know we have skips and dips, but boy, if we can fix or provide incentive and land assembly, you know, that's pretty challenging on some of these lots and areas, but some sort of, I don't want to say relaxed look at it, but very progressive look at how we, you know, address those and get where we can have blank or vacant land being better utilized in residential. Others, huge point, and I didn't want to move away from it that fast. You have my full support, you know, to hopefully we aggressively address that.
One of the things I'm most impressed with as I read through this was that concept of encouraging land assembly, because that's the hard thing to do, and Gordon and I have had a few conversations about it and trying to figure out how to do it, but the concept of encouraging somebody to get adjacent parcels, and the more land they add to their project in an infill, more land they assemble, the more their density bonus increases. So if they just develop a single lot, they just get the provisions that go with that single lot. And correct me if I'm explaining this incorrectly, but as they add land, they get bonus densities as they add land, especially in districts where you want to see, you know, like a downtown or a TOD type thing is where that helps out. And that's pretty, it's a pretty innovative concept. I don't know that that's done everywhere in the country, but I really appreciated that. And I know it took some time to get down to that concept, but that's something that we should really be aware of, because it's addressing that specific issue of that these small balkanized lots and trying to assemble them into great projects.
Is that by just parcel or by lot size? How's that graduation done?
The way that it would work is that the base zoning district would already be present. The council would, on their own, initiate this infill overlay district. Once the two are in place, as a property owner assembles lands around him, as their parcel size gets larger for their project, then rather than being a linear progression, for example, if you have 1 acre, you get one lot. If you get 2 acres, you get two lots, that type of thing. If you have, if you have up to 2.5 acres, it's the normal density, whatever the density for that zoning district is. If you get to a certain size threshold, then that density doubles. And so it becomes more of a geometric curve mathematically rather than just a linear progression. The thought is that you're rewarding somebody for aggressively assembling the lands.
But the trigger point's 2.5 acres.
I'd have to go back and read it. I wrote it a while ago. I don't have it memorized quite yet.
Yes, it is. That's correct.
Okay. So,
and the other thing we do is we allow for, you know, decreased or waived requirements for landscaping, parking, setback, some of the other costs that might not, the standards might not be fully needed, again, in these infill situations, but you can design some development so it really fits in it. The neighbors are all happy, but not necessarily have the full 10 or 15 foot side yard separation that might be required. And I think this is really going to be a good program. And by laying it all out ahead of time in a zone, they're not going to have to come in and negotiate. So they'll know it'll be much easier to work the deals out because it'll be all open. In Article 4, what we've done is taken that other part of the development, the design standards I mentioned that apply citywide, and organize those in a way that makes sense. So you have the general development standards, standards for the specific uses that you're concerned about, parking, landscaping, wireless communications, and then the nonconformities. Parking, the general development standards are just all about good site planning. I'm not going to go through the details, but they deal with all the things that site planners at the counter and the boards have dealt with all the time. The height limits and when do you grant exceptions. Lighting, trying to make sure that everything is shielded and you don't impose glare on your neighbors. Outdoor storage, pedestrian connections, just getting utilities and mechanical equipment screened from view. Thinking about the clear lines at the intersections, the setbacks, of course, keeping the swimming pool safe and secure from the toddlers and people walking in from the outside. Screening those trash collection units and truck loading docks, keeping them away from the single family neighborhoods, and promoting the visibility at the intersections so that there are no increased accidents. We've got drawings, more drawings again, so people know what is expected by these development standards. We put in one place all the standards for what are the potentially problematic uses, those that need a little more attention. Auto sales and services, just because of the activity. You want them on the arterial streets. That's where they get the drive-by traffic. You want some landscaping. You don't want them just paved up to the front yard so that there is some buffering. It just looks a little better. The car dealers will make a better attract clientele, be attractive in the community and with landscape separation. Similarly, with the auto vehicle repair, let's make sure it's the activities take place in buildings. They're not noisy. They're not creating those problems for the neighbors. No litter, no screening. Washing as well. We want the noise reduction standards. On convenience markets, we're trying to do two things. We want to support the shopping centers you have with the larger grocery stores, but we do want to allow the corner store to come out to be within walking distance. So you set a size limit on it, 5,000 square feet, and have a landscaping requirement and a setback from the residential zone. And that strikes a balance. So you're supporting the existing shopping centers, but you're allowing that corner store to be out where people might need it to walk to get a carton of milk. We look at hospitals, clinics, get some screening and spacing requirements. Live-work units are a new product, many like. I think you've probably heard of them, where most of the space in the unit is two-thirds is used for working, whether it's photography or pottery or some other activity, and the balance for living. You don't want these rented. You don't want these to be substandard apartment buildings. You do want outdoor living area. It's less than I talked about earlier, 150 square feet. But I think it's a good idea to promote more mixed use, to get more development, to get people doing business in the city, contributing if they sell something to your sales tax base. We carry forward the existing provisions for manufactured homes. We have new standards for the outdoor eating areas, certification requirements, handling the refuse. We have standards for outdoor retail sales, no interference with the pedestrian circulation and limits on how high you can stack things. I'll always remember writing these once years ago and someone said, oh, these aren't outdoor retail sales. This is things for pickup, for customer pickup. Well, you don't have the customers yet. Well, we're hoping to get the customer. They'd stack the things out. So it's very, very important to get the outdoor retail sales rules in place to deal with the pawn shops and tattoo parlors. We don't really change anything, but we put them in there. Similarly, we think swap meets, farmers markets are great, but they better be good neighbors. They better clean up their stuff after they're done. They shouldn't be drinking during the market. And if they do all that, I think they're fine. Parking and loading was actually a fun module to work on. Gordon set up an online blog after taking it through the committees, and we had a moderated online forum where people could talk about their parking ideas for a 24-48 hour period, and then closed it down. But it was another way that we've used in this update process to reach out to people who don't normally come to meetings or have a busy schedule. And what emerged from the parking and loading... We've got a couple big ideas that came out of this. We've got some compact parking, 20% of the total, a maximum parking for the surface lots of 125% of the minimum, with the idea that, you know, as you do go to have more transit, as the rail comes to town, you certainly don't want to be inheriting large surface parking lots. So we wanted to have some limits on the total amount space. There can always be exceptions through the design study, so Gordon can grant relief. And we give as well credit for the on-street space. Why not? It's been something that the city has built, and that reduces the cost of private developments because they're not having to build the spaces that now they get credit for. And we're allowing for alternative designs that are green. And I think that makes sense as well. It's not just LEED in a couple cases. You'll notice we always say LEED or equivalent. We don't want to give LEED the monopoly. And they're very expensive in post-occupancy testing. So we've got some drawings. And we're promoting the idea of shared parking. If you think about uses where the times don't overlap, the office peak is during the day, the residential peaks are morning and the evening in the restaurants, you can cut the overall parking requirements in a mixed use, a shared facility by 20 to 25%.
I'm gonna hop in here because I knew you were gonna get to this and address it. And I just wanted to praise this concept. It's a great concept. Scott Summers and I talk a lot about we need to create a parking problem in downtown Mesa. That means we have a lot of business and we have a lot of activity down here. And this concept coming out explicitly in the zoning code is a really good one. And if I remember right, the way to regulate it was some kind of agreement or certification. How were we regulating those daytime and nighttime uses?
Well, you would have a study that would show what the basis for the reduction is. And then it's just with the mix of uses. You're not, if they've demonstrated that there is a shared parking case to be made to reduce the overall requirement, you approve it as a condition of approval.
Okay.
And then if they change the use mix, so the residential component goes to 100% office, they have to come back and show how they're meeting the additional parking needs.
Got it.
To add on to that, the city of Tempe, when they modified their code a few years ago, they adopted a table that seems to be very well accepted by the industry. One of the things that we would probably do as we go forward in this process is adopt that same table as a reference. We wouldn't make it the study that they had to use. We would be open to other studies that would be submitted by other traffic engineers, but we would submit that as possibly a base document that they could use for someone who may not necessarily want to hire a traffic engineer. They could use that table and calculate shared parking on their own.
In fact, the ULI also has a little program, a little CD. You can come in, you put in all your uses, and it calculates the program, the shared parking reduction for you. Typically, we don't want the ordinance to commit to one formula. We want to use the kind of tables that Gordon has. If they've got a traffic engineer, ULI has a table. In the Bay Area, a couple of the transportation agencies have been developing their tables. As transit is extended from Dobson, you'll have a slightly different set of curves. So you want to be able to evolve as you go forward. We're specifically providing in parking for alternative compliance. let someone come forward as you talk about downtown. Let them say, oh, and we've got a valet component for, you know, the Thanksgiving to Christmas period, and this is how we're going to do it. Or we've got a project that's age restricted, and we don't need, we're going to have golf carts for the residents to go to the corner store, so we're not going to have quite as great a need. We want the city to be able to say yes, to not have to come to the council for an amendment on that or make them go through a board of adjustment process. In the same way for landscaping. You've had a set of landscape requirements that are suburban, and then many of the new landscaping really looks great. But as you move to sometimes some of the tighter lots, as you come into downtown, or a new architect wants to bring in a really nice native project with good plant variety and work with the topography or the desert highlands that you mentioned, we should be able to say yes to that. So we call that an alternative landscape compliance, where we have criteria and we let them present their case for a good new design that might fit in on Main Street, wherever it be. I think this is the flexibility you want to still keep the bar high. So you let them change the plant types and sizes, dimensions, ground treatment, and irrigation plans, and it is a discretionary decision on your part. And there has to be a finding that it's compatible with the landscaping and the environment. On the antennas, the cell antennas, we write a lot of these around the country and are pretty much bringing you know, the current benchmark, the state of the art for these regulations. The trend is to expect more stealth facilities where they're concealed. You don't want to see them, or at most you want them mounted on the building. So we're expressing a preference for design, a preference for location, and there's some spacing requirements, and you want co-location. Besides that, this is generally an approach that the industry supports. Gordon's taken it out for some comments. We haven't gotten a lot of pushback during the public review. There may be more, but I think the way we're suggesting you regulate telecommunication facilities is the way most cities, large cities, are doing it.
Councilman Kavanaugh has a question.
I have a question to that point. In looking at the code, proposed code on page 4-82, with regard to regulation of the wireless communication facilities and antennas, there will be a prohibition on erecting them within any city park. Is that what our current code states, and this is just transferred into it, or is that a change that you're proposing?
That's quite honestly, that's something that I didn't catch when I was doing my editing, and it's probably something I need to change. There was the council policy about 3 or 4 years ago, specifically adopted a set of guidelines for placing wireless antennas or cell towers in park sites. The process goes through the Parks and Recreation Board, and then it goes through a special use permit process through the zoning administrator.
Right. No, and I'm familiar with that because there are some current proposals for those in parks, and
right.
I happen to like this policy. That's why when I saw it, that's why I was saying, oh, this is a good move, or was it, and is it in our existing policy?
No, it was the past council made that change in policy specifically as a fundraising.
Was that a policy change, or was that a change in our ordinance? Was that direction that was given?
No, we had council direction, there was an amendment to the code, and there was an amendment to the existing guidelines, and there was a new guideline document that was drawn up specifically addressing how to incorporate cell tower design into parks.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically states that they can do that through co-location on athletic field poles.
Correct.
And then the second option is,
and I'm comfortable with that,
the stealth option, which is the faux tree type of thing.
Right.
And there's a couple of those that are already installed in the city.
Right. And the issue is sometimes the stealth trees look like a redwood tree in the middle of a bunch of small pinyon pines. And you know, what's the process that you go through to evaluate the context of the park that it's in?
That's why the policy went through the Parks and Recreation Board, with the evaluation and came through that group, and then their recommendation came forward for final approval for the with a special use permit through the zoning administrator hearing officer.
Okay, so if Parks and Recreation make a recommendation, or is it an actual vote, or how does the current code work?
They vote on it, and then, so it's basically to allow the activity to take place in the park, and then we follow that up with a use permit that actually entitles the tower at that particular location. There's also a leasing process that it goes through.
Right, and I understand, and there also may be some instances where it may be reviewed by the Parks and Recreation Board, but it also would go to the Planning and Zoning Board for some sort of review or action?
No, not in the case of a cell tower. It would either go to the zoning administrator hearing officer or the Board of Adjustment.
Okay.
Which is the board they would normally go to.
Right, and council has no role in that, other than to object as an individual?
Yes. That's the way the process is set up.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I like what's in here, so.
Great. Well, moving on, what we've done in non-conforming uses is slightly different than what you currently have. The first thing you always want to do in a non-conforming chapter, as you're thinking about a new ordinance, is to not create new needless non-conformities. So you don't want to have more uses or more structures become non-conforming. But you have a community where you've inherited buildings from Maricopa County that may not fit in. Some of these may be just fine in the neighborhood. So we've created the idea that we could have a class one non-conforming use and allow some expansion. So you wouldn't say, no, just because you got built under county standards doesn't mean you have to be torn down and rebuilt to the current city standards. If you're a benign, you fit in, you don't pose any health and safety issues, you're class one non-conforming, you could expand. Class two uses, by contrast, maybe involving electroplating or some other health and safety issue, you don't want ever to expand. You want them out. So the new idea here is to say that there really are acceptable non-conforming uses that might continue to fit in where the neighbors are all comfortable versus those that really do cause health and safety issues and we want moved out. And we would allow structural restoration and repair for less than 50% and have a termination schedule for the problematic facilities. One reason we're here to you in 3 years and not longer is signs was not part of this update. Signs, the current sign regulations remain and will be taken on at some future date. The city is undergoing a separate effort to develop some form-based standards for the rail stations planned for the transit extension and the rail corridor. And they're looking at hiring a form-based consultant who would do these form first set of regulations that would apply in this area and then might be available on a voluntary basis for other parts of the city. So this would, Article 6 is reserved for these form-based standards when that study is complete. Administration is how you carry out the code, who's in charge of what. And we outline clearly the duties of every body, hearing officer, zoning administrator, historic preservation committee. Don't have changes, just put it all in one place in a clear way. In the same way what we've done in the common procedures chapter is bring all of these procedures together. So you say in one place, what are the form requirements, how citizen participation handled, the conduct of hearings, findings, dates, expirations, extensions, and modifications. You only have to deal with that once for all the discretionary permits, and it's really the way new ordinances are written. You don't put the fees in the ordinance. You want the ability to change them by resolution annually or biannually or whenever you need. Similarly, citizen participation, we carried forward the existing requirements and have the reports submitted. We're saying how notice is handled, how hearings are conducted in a proper decorum, and what appeal procedures are. All ordinances need to provide relief, and this is through appeals or through variances. We keep the use permit and variance procedures largely the way you have bring forward the dips and skips I'd mentioned. But the emphasis now is on the findings and conditions of approval. So it's that approach of being clear what your expectations are, when you'll grant the relief. In the same way, we have a clear process that we've worked out and reviewed with the legal counsel for the general plan and zoning map amendment procedures. So they're clarified, the major amendments versus the minor amendments that statutes wanted are spelled out. And we have an appeal process with the timeline built in, because the developers don't want to be have an uncertainty. They need to know that there's some finality and that their approval rights vest at some point. The ordinance closes with descriptions, the definitions I'd mentioned, descriptions of the use types organized alphabetically. And we pulled all of the specific topics that might relate to airports or parking or all into the one set of definitions, but organize them in a way that's going to be easy to find them. And you never do policy in a definition. So many of these have been tightened up clean, intended to be plain English at the end. Well, that's the story. That's what we've been doing for you.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a long time in coming. I know there's a number of questions. One I have in particular is with the renaming of some categories, some zoning categories, we've added a couple. Are we going to run into any problems with 207? How are we going to fit people into some of those new categories, like the residential?
The $64,000 question. Vice Mayor Jones, we're still looking at that, quite honestly. The intent through this ordinance is to expand opportunity.
Right.
We've tried to go out of our way to make it not only easier, but to expand the options that people have for the use of their property. Our gut feel is that's not going to diminish value, which is the catch-all for a Prop 207 question. But there still needs to be a district-by-district analysis done so that we're confident that that takes place.
And ultimately, at some point, you give them the choice of where they want to fall with their property?
Yes.
With the intent of what's around the neighborhood and stuff. But we just have to make sure we address that.
Vice Mayor, Council, it also depends a lot on how this new code is implemented. If we have the new code and we still have the old code, and as long as people do not change their zoning code, they can maintain their current zone, and the same whatever's permissible now will be permissible later, then there's certainly no Prop 207 claims. We can encourage people, and if they see that there's more flexibility in the new code and they come forward and they voluntarily change their zoning code to the new code, then there's no Prop 207 claims either. The issue is, if we go in and the city of Mesa rezones, then are there changes to their zoning laws? Arguably, yes. But then the second question is, as Gordon said, does that diminish their property value? How this code is implemented has not yet been decided, but we are very closely looking at that issue and how can we make this transition without triggering any Prop 207 claims.
Scott, you had a comment. Or taken care of. Okay, Dave, go ahead.
Don't forget to define bypass parcel. Didn't see that one in the back.
What's that?
He read that very carefully and found the same mistake I did on the airplane, which is that I forgot to put the definition of bypass parcel in here, but we emailed it to Gordon yesterday. It will be in
I'd like to personally approve that.
It will be in the public review draft.
All right. Alex?
Okay, mine's going to be a little lengthy. I'll try to make it as quickly as possible. I've been working with Gordon and staff. Everybody knows District 2 doesn't have malls, it doesn't have airports, but it has lots of houses. So I get a lot of neighborhood issues that I deal with. Right after being sworn in, confronted with a very angry neighborhood, and what had happened is
And this is an issue on 224, page 224, with regard to side yard setbacks. And the challenge being that a very savvy neighbor was very concerned about temporary or structures being put up in the side yard setbacks, specifically storage sheds. And the challenge being is, as everybody knows, in Home Depots, Sam's, they sell these types of structures. They could be plastic, they could be metal. And those, because we live in Arizona in the monsoons, people tend to buy those and then attach them either to the ground or to the building. And that was a great concern. So we had code enforcement go out and write up about six or eight of the neighbors in there and then talk to lots of others. So the neighborhood was quite concerned. I think if you take the opportunity to drive around any neighborhood that's been built in the last 20 years, you'll see that folks pretty much do that. You'll find a large portion of houses that have storage sheds or structures. It could be tough sheds or whatever, but they're in the side yard setback. What I'm hoping to promote with my fellow council members is, and see if I can get the support, Vice Mayor, is to see if we could direct council or direct staff to somehow draft a reasonable exception or an allowance for side yard setback encroachments involving storage sheds. Of all the enforcement concerns that we have code enforcement dealing with, this is probably, in my mind, the least of what some big problems could be. And I've had a long conversation with Gordon. I think some of the concerns that I've heard is the problem with allowing in the wider portion of a side yard setback, you need vehicular access to the back if they're going to put a pool in or have some maintenance issues, and you don't want to develop a canyoning effect between homes. So if we can find some sort of compromise opportunity to write into exceptions maybe on the side yard setback, and then if there's an opportunity for the committee that looks at Board of Adjustments, thank you. Some sort of opportunity to allow some flexibility for Board of Adjustments to look at a situation and maybe use some common sense. The impact or the feedback I'm getting from neighborhoods in a couple of specific cases is it is so rigid and so there's no allowance for it that Board of Adjustment feels like their hands are a little tied. So I'm trying to make that as quickly as possible, not tie up. Gordon is keenly aware of this, and if I can get fellow council support to say let's look at a couple of written in options for side yard setbacks, it's kind of what's happening out there. Is it the most important code issue that we have to deal with? Can we work through it? And that's what I'm hoping, a reasonable look at it. So thank you, Vice Mayor.
On Alex's issue, I think what you have to do is bring in the fire department and the fire code into that conversation as well. My suspicion would be that the setbacks also are tied to the fire code, and if you have a wooden tough shed full of stuff, which typically is gasoline for the riding mower and propane tanks and all sorts of things, and it's 1 foot away from your property line and 3 foot away from the neighbor's house, there's going to be a concern there about the propagation of fire from one structure to the other. So you're going to have that conversation. I also think you have to kind of look at some of the development regulations for outdoor storage in Chapter 4. You have a very nice picture here of pallets, screen walls, and a property line on page 16 of the council's PowerPoint presentation. That probably has to tie into any residential setbacks as well, so that it makes sense. Because what you have here is making sure that a commercial user is a good neighbor to a property, and that there's some screening involved, and still there's some setback from the property line. So if there's a residential neighbor, should probably be a good neighbor to his or her neighbor as well. So making sure that this ties into to what Alex is looking at. So that would be my suggestion, is if we're going to look at that, which I'm fine with, we need to make sure that it makes sense and that we're not going to create a massive fire hazard somewhere.
That's a follow-up, sir.
firefighter to firefighter?
Yeah. We've actually had that, Gordon and I, the building code, you know, the construction, the materials used, things like that. Gordon was going to do some research to see how that could be addressed. You know, the propagation, if you have a crappy old wood structure, is it going? And you know what kills me? I got to tell you, just briefly, Vice Mayor, if I could. I'm dealing with two situations, this one in this neighborhood and another neighborhood. I have a complaints of a commercial vehicle lift in the backyard that's allowed, that isn't prohibited by the code. So these people put their personal vehicles on this commercial lift, lift it up above the fence line, and work throughout, you know, time to fix vehicles. That is allowed on the code. But a storage shed, metal, that you buy at Home Depot attached to the side isn't. It just kills me sometimes. So I'm hoping we can find some common sense and reasonable, you know, person look at some of these issues to get through them. But
a commercial lift in their own backyard.
Yes, sir.
Interesting. All right. Other questions? Comments? So timeline. So this is now going to, we have this put together. It's going to go out public review. And we will continue our own reading through it, and then we'll come back and
right.
and see what timeline are we looking at then?
We'll take some of the comments that we got from the Planning and Zoning Board and from you this morning. We'll make some of those editing changes, develop that public review draft, and then beginning with the start of the new year, we'll start doing that very aggressive public review process. We anticipate going to the Planning and Zoning Board based on the type of feedback we get either in March or April. We anticipate two hearings in front of that board. So if we start in March, it'll be March and April. If we start in April, it'll be April and May. Then we would anticipate coming back to Council in June, or May or June, depending upon how that works out. And we're going to try to keep this as tight as we can, but if we seem to be getting a lot of feedback, we want to make sure that we collect all that and make sure we have a very strong consensus before adoption before we come back to council for that with that.
All right. Thank you. With that then, we'll hear reports on meetings or conferences attended, and a number of us were very occupied last week in San Antonio for National League of Cities Convention, and I would like to congratulate Councilmember Kavanaugh for being elected to the National League of Cities Board for a two-year term there. And a number of us serve on committees and had very successful meetings. We garnered a lot of information, and we feel it's important to become involved both State League and MAG and at National League of Cities, where we have a voice and give a lot of input. Dennis.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. I'd like to report on two things related to that conference. I have served on the Information Technology and Communications Steering Committee for the National League of Cities, which incidentally also reviews policy related to wireless towers and issues like that. So I have a passion for how good they are, how bad they are. But the that steering committee completed a complete revision, rewrite of the policy statement for the National League of Cities. And again, put a special emphasis on the need for good broadband access in our communities across the country, both for commercial and business purposes, as well as residential purposes. And is going to be continuing to advocate very strongly to the administration on the need for that, both in rural areas and in urban areas. And in the second area that I participated in last week, as you know, Mesa Public Schools, Mesa Community Colleges have moved forward in the grant process called the CLIP grants, which is part of the Gates Foundation as well as the National League of Cities. And I was very pleased to see so much leadership from our community who attended that conference for the planning session for the CLIP grants. Chancellor Glasper from the Community College District, Dr. Pan, Dr. Cowan, city manager, I think formed a great team, and we're moving forward in that project. Our goal in that is to devise a strategy in our community to ensure that our kids and residents both graduate from high school, continue on through college, and graduate from college. But Mesa is now in the top tier, I think, of I think it's 7 cities that have moved on to that process. And later, or in 2010, we hope to be one of the communities that selected as a finalist for a $3 million grant from the Gates Foundation. But there was some very important work done at the NLC conference by the leadership team, which I really appreciated. That demonstrated to the National League of Cities the commitment of our community and the partnership with the other governmental entities within the valley here on the importance of education and graduation. Thank you.
Dave?
I just wanted to give a big thank you to our Solid Waste Division for this door hanger that they have been dropping in neighborhoods that talk about recycling, proper barrel placement. I think it's really well designed. They've done a really good job. I just wanted to say thank you and give kudos to our staff and the division that has been doing it. We have such a comprehensive recycling program. My office in Phoenix now gives me all 7 through 3 recyclables because Phoenix doesn't take all recyclable numbers. I went in my office yesterday and had this big box of recyclables to bring to Mesa for proper disposal.
Take them home, put them in your own barrel.
I just wish I was getting
those. If you
were
the neighborhood person, yeah, to get the credits for.
Yeah,
it's going to be part of a recycle bank.
I just have to do it to do the right thing, right?
It's been, I have to cut this down because it's been quite a while since we've had this particular item, and we've been in and out of the state a lot, participating regionally and even nationally in National League of Cities. I participated a couple of weeks ago in the Arizona Town Hall, which looked at state financing and came to the conclusion that the state really needs to take a look at the Constitution and make some changes in the structure of organization. You heard a lot about this with the O'Connor House project. Much of it was discussed as well. But the National League of Cities, we've discussed a lot of issues, and it's been very impressed in the leadership, both of you, Vice Mayor, and Dennis taking the reins of the board of directors there, and how important involvement of this body is in regional issues. One of our objectives, of course, is regional leadership, and there's very practical benefits to this community that we have seen from our leadership in these organizations, such as the CLIP grant, the COPS grants, the fire stations we're adding, transit dollars that are all coming into Mesa so that we can build a better Mesa, improve public safety and transit options. Several of us also participated in the RAF Memorial Service. That was the 65th, just before Veterans Day. It was a fantastic service, and quite a number of people showed up. I think that was one of the best attended events in a long time. Got to meet several members of the Royal Air Force, and being a U.S. Air Force veteran, we had some fun conversations with those folks.
And the Consul General.
And the Consul General.
Dame Barbara Hay.
Yes, thank you. We had had the opportunity to meet with her as well. Also, we wanted to thank staff, particularly personnel, and Mr. Brady, unfortunately, who is not here, for their hospitality in hosting some folks from China, specifically Mongolia, who came to Arizona through Arizona State University, learn more about human resource management in government, local government particularly, and they were looking for lessons learned from the United States, and they came to Mesa to talk to us. I heard through ASU that they felt that the Mesa tour was by far their most productive tour. One of the things that they are taking back is the council's strategic initiatives and how we utilize that to shape our budget, to measure the performance of our city management staff, and just to build a better community. So they were very appreciative of the hospitality. So please pass it on.
Will do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thanks, Vice Mayor. Just wanted to remind everybody, this Saturday is the grand day of service in District 2 and District 4. We're expecting, I know just in District 2, over 500 young people to provide service to the surrounding neighborhoods in Central and South Central Mesa, and really appreciate a tremendous amount of effort that's been done with that, with Susan Fabroda, Katie Brown, and Markeisha Griffin putting together those resources. It's very labor-intensive, but I think our community is going to be served well by these youth and the service. They're painting homes and making some public safety provisions and painting address numbers and things. It's just a wonderful effort, and I know we're excited to have those both in Vice Mayor Jones and our district, so thank you.
And a big thank you to all the staff who's putting that together. You mentioned a few names, and I assisted Miranda. We have a lot going on and a lot of interest in volunteers who are going to be doing a lot of service work here, not just Saturday, but in upcoming weeks, a lot of service projects going on. That's what's, it's tremendous to have volunteerism that really makes a difference in commitment to community. What was it? A couple nights ago, everything's running together. Tuesday night, I believe,
yeah.
was the kickoff for our Building Stronger Neighborhood back for a neighborhood in District 4. Mm-hmm. So that program continues. We just keep moving district to district every few months and have neighbor participation. We had a very good response. So thank you to all those who helped in that. If nothing else, then, Carrie, do you have meetings?
A few things, Vice Mayor, Council. I wanted to mention that our United Food Bank, which is located here in Mesa, is in dire need of turkeys this holiday season. And actually, yesterday, city staff got together and we set a goal of donating 500 turkeys this Tuesday and another 500 turkeys that we will be providing for the Christmas holiday season. And so today you're going to see employees in jeans. They're paying $2 to go towards purchasing turkeys for next Tuesday. Recall next Tuesday, the Great Turkey Tuesday, in which the United Food Bank will have a truck located at the Convention Center parking lot from 7 to 1, and employees will be bringing in their turkeys on that day. So I wanted to let you know that's going on in the organization, and there's a lot of enthusiasm around that project since it kicked off yesterday, and we only have a few days until Tuesday, so we're excited about that. This Saturday also, I wanted to mention the Mesa Arts and Cultural Festival is from 10 to 4. Next Thursday, because of Thanksgiving, we don't have a study session. Next study session will be December 3rd at 7:30. And also wanted to mention on December 5th, District 3, Councilmember Kavanaugh's district, will be hosting a pancake breakfast and a holiday toy drive at Station 207, which is at 2505 South Dobson Road. And please bring a new toy, and that's going to go towards Andrea's Closet in the Cardin's Children's Medical Center. So our next council meeting will be December 7th. That's all, Vice Mayor.
If I might add, I appreciate, I now see that some of the council are donating their $2. I didn't mean it that way. But
it's a council shakedown, knowing that most of us are up here in jeans, not knowing that was the deal, but because we're going to be going to work.
We very much appreciate it.
Here's the council donation.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
And you've got it now.
Thank you. Very
all
much.
Of us up here.
Thank you.
Can I make a question to Jeremy before you shake it up? Before the next shakedown? No. First, items from citizens present. Do we have any?
No.
Then with that, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn. Motion second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you.